All right, so now is time for our speaker. I have seen this gentleman in meetings. I can't say I have heard him speak, but this is one of the things that I look forward to in meetings. So I look forward to listening to, let me introduce a fellow on Al-Anon, Kevin. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
I remember I used to describe myself, how I came into Al-Anon, and I would say that when I first arrived at Al-Anon, I was a liar and a coward. And it was true, but it was part of why I needed this program, because it was said for effect. It didn't encompass what was really going on with me. I lied a lot. I was taught how to lie as a young child. My parents would be rather upset to hear that, but I was born with some health problems, and some of the treatments were really painful, somewhat humiliating, and I would scream. And my mother finally came to me and she said, you're scaring the other children. You have to stop. And that was the first lesson in subjugating my feelings and lying, because it hurt. And screaming in pain was the truth. And gritting my teeth and being stoically silent was a lie. But I was rewarded for it. So I kept lying. And I got really, really, really good at lying. And then I began to lie rather than tell the truth, even when it was easy. If I was a few minutes late for work, oh, there was an accident, there was this, there was that. Dragons. I mean, it was just... But the other reason I lied was I was afraid of everything. And I felt that because I felt fear, that made me a coward. Now, I did things throughout my life that people would probably look at it and say, well, that took courage, but I didn't see it that way because I was afraid. And my sponsor, I wish he was here, Ernesto, said to me, he said, I think you've got that a little wrong. He said, fear's good. He said, if someone points a gun at you, you should be afraid. And I thought back, and I had a drunk pull a hunting knife on me and tell me he was going to cut my heart out one time. And I dealt with it. So I came to this program thinking I was a coward, but I did things at times that were courageous. But because I had an human feeling of fear, I took that to mean that I was a coward. And it wasn't until I got to this program that I realized I was allowed to have human feelings. I learned early on, I was rewarded for stoicism with the illness that I had, with my parents' divorce. I remember coming home going, Mom, I think I broke my arm. I mean, it was shattered and blue, but I didn't want to cry because I got praise for being stoic. And for me, and why I really ended up in these rooms and needed these rooms, was I felt that was love. I was insane by the time I got to these rooms. I think the three stories, quick ones I can tell, that sort of encompass where I was when I came to this. I was so shut down and so unwilling to look at who I was and what I wanted in life. I met a woman on our third date. She said, you know, all I want for Christmas, what would really make me happy, is just to marry you. Well, all righty then. So we got married. I knew it was a mistake. My friends tried to talk me out of it. But my mother said, if you give your word on something, you can't take it back. And I believe that. So I said I was going to marry her. I didn't say I loved her. And I didn't say I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her. I said I would marry her, and I did that. I have to live with the fact that I was a terrible, terrible husband. I justified it, and I'll get to this later, but one of the keys I know when I'm wrong is if I have to justify something. Because if I'm justifying it, I'm lying to myself, and I'm doing something that I know I shouldn't do. But I was a terrible husband. I was not faithful. I did not treat her well. I wasn't abusive, but she was a drunk. And I don't like being around people who drink. So I avoided my wife at all costs. And that's on me. It had nothing to do with her alcoholism. It had nothing to do with her personality or how she treated me. It was 100% my justification of the fact that she was a drunk, so I got to do whatever I wanted, which was play baseball or softball 4 nights a week, baseball on Saturdays, poker every other Wednesday, and go water skiing with my friends during the summer. Not really much room for marriage in there. And I've had to come to terms with that. In the moment, in the heat of the moment, as she was stumbling down drunk or staying out all night on our first anniversary and all those things, I could justify the behavior because I had no recovery. I had no program. And so I would tell myself, well, you know, this is okay and that's okay. And the bottom line is, I was a bad husband. And I'm sorry for that. The things I would do to get myself to feel, on a job site once, I was on a building that was 4 stories high. There was a neighboring building 4 stories high. And I thought it would be fun to jump back and forth. And the wall was only 6 inches wide that I was landing on. And I thought that was fun. And I felt a real thrill because of that. Which is odd because that doesn't really fit in with the whole cowardice thing. Being a cowardly daredevil, it's a strange dichotomy, but it made me feel good. It made me feel alive. I used to joke, I'm not working until I'm bleeding. I used to have a lot of injuries. A lot of cuts, a lot of stitches, a lot of broken bones. But it was good because I could feel, I felt alive, you know. There's nothing like, which I did do, falling 2 stories headfirst on the pavement to make you feel real searing pain. But even then, in the process of that, I remember when the first responder was a cop, and he was like, you know, when I came to, he was asking me questions, and finally he said, do you know what happened? And I said, yeah, I asked my boss for a raise, and he got pissed and pushed me off the roof. I still remember his face, because he's sitting there, my boss is sitting there, and his eyes got really big. But I didn't want to say, you know, I fell, I'm hurt, take care of me, which is what I wanted to say. Please, somebody take care of me. You know, make the pain go away. And then the last story, which some of the guys here who recognize me are familiar with, I was divorced from my wife and dating, I guess you could call it. It wasn't really dating. It was just me feeling uncomfortable all the time. And I met a woman, and I asked her out, and she said yes and stood me up. And I was like, all right, yeah, that's par for the course. And I ran into her a week later, and I was like, pretty sure we had a date on Saturday. And she goes, I know, I'm really sorry. I was getting married. I said, all right, okay. Well, what are you doing this weekend? She goes, well, all right. So we went out, and this isn't even the crazy part. I haven't gotten to that yet. So she invites me back to her place, and we're there in varying stages of undress, and there's pounding on the door and pounding on the door and screaming, and I was like, who the hell is that? She goes, it's probably my husband. So I go to the door and I look through the peephole and I see chest. And I said, how big is your husband? She said, oh, he's like 6'7", 6'8". I said, is he a violent man? Pretty much. We had to call the sheriffs to come and escort me to my car while they restrained him so I could go home from my date. Now I'm getting to the insane part. I called her up and we went out again the next week. So you can see that I am at home in these rooms. And I think, I know in my heart that at that point my higher power went, I've got to do something with this kid or he's going to end up dead. And what my higher power did was introduce me to this woman, Tracy, my beloved wife. And we went out on a date, and a real one, actually. Took her to the worst movie ever made. And as we walked up the aisle and I was like, oh my God, I blew it. She's never gonna go out with me again. She looked at me and she smiled. She said, I'll pick the next movie. So we went to a little place and we were having coffee and dessert and we were talking and she brought up Al-Anon. And I remember tensing immediately because I had other people talk to me about Al-Anon. Now, I don't know how they talked to me about Al-Anon, but how I took it was, you're screwed up and you need to go to this place and go to these meetings because you are a mess. That's what my brain would hear when anyone would give me even the most constructive of criticism. But what she said, which has always stuck with me, going through her own issues, which is not my place to say, and if you guys have any brains at all, you'll ask her to speak at this meeting. She said, I was married to an alcoholic, and my life is crazy. My life is now a whole lot less crazy. I got from here to here with Al-Anon. So I went to one meeting. I thought, well, she's so gorgeous, I'll go to one meeting. halfway through understanding ourselves, tears are streaming down my face. I'm white knuckling my chair and I run out to the parking lot and I just sit down and just sob because I knew I was home. I knew that there was a place where other people counted drinks, where I would put stuff in my neighbor's recycling so that the amount of booze bottles and beer cans in our recycling didn't seem out of the ordinary for one person. So I went. And then I went with her. And what was really important was I started going to meetings by myself. I didn't go to just the meetings that she could make. I went to other meetings. And a man, I'm sure a lot of you remember Bobby, the nurse, blonde-haired Bobby, said, you should try the men's group in La Cañada. I think you might like that. Now, a lot of the pain and anguish in my life came at the hands of men, and so I thought, a men's group? I don't know. But again, showing signs of pure cowardice, I went anyway. 15 guys sitting over there. The cool guys were on one side of the room because they could tilt their chairs and lean against the wall. I didn't make it to the cool side of the room for about 2 years, but it was good. And I had the great good fortune to work with a young man sitting over there at the end, Mr. Jack C. And another young man, Ernesto, who's not here. And what I learned was that I had to stop play acting. I had to stop trying to anticipate what people wanted to hear. And I had to start telling the truth, which was the scariest part of my recovery. Because I'd spent a lifetime developing various personas. Not that I have split personality, but when I'm on the construction site, I'm this guy. When I was in a play with theater people, I was this guy. When I was around my parents, I was this guy. And so I was all these people, and I spent so much time developing various personas and becoming these individual parts that I never once took the time to say, ask myself who I was, what I really wanted out of life. You know, I was, at the time, I was trying to be an actor because I felt like if I could just get the big part, people would love me. And I'd been trying that my whole life. If I could just get that right car, then when I drove up, I'd be respected. I remember getting my red Jeep Cherokee and driving home, and I wasn't any different. I was the same guy, and it was so disappointing. I spent so much of my life really, truly loathing myself. And not being able to talk to anyone about it. And I could come here and I could share my deepest fears and I could talk about terrible things that I'd done, and sometimes appropriately and sometimes inappropriately, people would laugh. And I stopped taking that part of myself so seriously. And over the years, I'll be celebrating 20 years next year, I was able to let that part of it go. That I was insufficient. How I grew up was, my mother married an alcoholic who abandoned us. He got remarried again and then left that family and became a woman. So he had his own issues. And it wasn't until I got to Al-Anon that I stopped being angry with him and had empathy. My mom went from an alcoholic to a Holocaust survivor, which was a whole different set of issues. And in my house, I don't want to say verbal abuse, but humiliation was okay. It was okay to say whatever you wanted. Which is why I learned to be careful and not say what I really thought or really felt, because it's safer that way. If I don't tell you who I really am, if I don't tell you how I really feel, then if you don't like how I pretend to feel, it's not that big a deal because that's not really me. So I kept that guy really hidden inside. The problem with that is, Tracy and I got married. She had two amazing daughters that now call me dad, which has been one of the greatest joys of my life. But if you're not willing to look at yourself, if you're not willing to go there, and I mean all the way there, you can't be a husband, you can't be a father. Not a real one, not the one that I always wanted. I hear people say, well, my parents did the best they could, and I love my parents, and my dad passed away this year, and we achieved a wonderful level of peace between the two of us because of this program. But I feel like my parents did the best that they were willing to do. And I know that sounds like a nitpicky, but it's true. They were able to do better. I watched their generosity of spirit and the giving that they did. They were both teachers to their children. When my dad got sick, kids flew that he had taught years before from all around the world to see him. But what I had to get past, and what this program helped me get past, was the things like getting ready to go to my first dance and thinking that I was sharp. And my dad looked at me and he went, "Ugh, you look like a fag." So I went back to my room and, you know, really felt like shit. And that was okay in my house. You know, just all sorts of different things that I don't really need to get into, but it made me realize that I had to keep everyone out there because they were too dangerous inside. Inside of here, they can cut you up and hurt you and injure you. Out there, they're just, you know, Charlie Brown parents. Wah, 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 wah. But I was in a new world. I was a husband. I was a father. And then we had a child together, and Maddie Potato. And I had to step up my game, and I didn't. I struggled with it. It took me a while. It took me a third sponsor, who oddly enough isn't even in Al-Anon. He's in AA, but he kicked my ass. And the thing he told me was, you got to take Tracy out of the equation. In your recovery, she does not exist. Now, that was so alien to me because I was raised to take care of everyone. I was the youngest. I was the peacemaker in my house. When my sister stopped taking her medication, I quit my job and I flew to New York and I took care of her kids. When my brother was drunk and on a bender and he couldn't make his child support payments, I made them for him and I did la, 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 and take care and take care, because that validated me. And I wasn't getting validation. So I had to get it where I could. So I had to prove my worth on a daily basis. But I was in a whole different world now. I was in it, you know, daily, every day. And I was making those crappy, awful comments that my parents made to me, and they were hurtful. And my wife, Tracy, was like, you gotta stop that. You gotta stop that, you know? And I had to work on that. And what he said was, okay, but getting back to that, was you have to take her out of the equation, because if you don't find recovery for yourself, you and Tracy will get divorced and you'll meet someone else and you'll be right here again. Do you want to be right here again? And that was a seminal moment in my life, because I was able to really honestly look inside and go, no, I don't want to be here again. I want to be a good husband. I want to be a good father. I want to figure my shit out so I can stop being afraid. Afraid that she'll leave me, because who's there to talk to? This multiple persona guy who tries to, you know, make sure she's okay, instead of the guy who can be honest. You know, that was hard for me. It's still hard. We were at a Easter function, and I was really uncomfortable. It's funny, I'm not uncomfortable around Al-Anon, but I'm uncomfortable around, you know, the people out there. It always reminds me of the line in Witness when he says, "You be careful out there among them English," and that's how I feel. Like I'm okay in here because I'm a freak, but I'm a freak amongst my fellow freaks. So. We were there, and I was talking to a guy, and I instantly went into that frame of mind of greater than, less than, and I viewed him as greater than. And she came over and was trying so hard to get me to shut up. And when we got home, it's one of the joys of having a partner that's in the program. She was able to sit down and go, "This is what I noticed you were doing." But it was a breakthrough for me, because I have like a physical key now. I know when I get that feeling on the back of my neck and my skin starts to crawl a little, that I'm feeling less than. I'm feeling small. So I do that cat thing. I try to make myself big by talking a little bit louder than I normally do and pontificating. Yeah, she's cracking up because it's so true. And I was able to look at that. And I'll be honest, there was a long stretch of time where I coveted speaking at this meeting. It was all I wanted to do, because all the other guys got to do it. No one would pick me, and that meant you hated me, and fuck you. What I realized is, my higher power was helping me, was I wasn't ready to speak at this meeting, or any meeting really, because it wasn't until that moment that I realized that if I had come here before that conversation, I wouldn't have shared my experience, strength, and hope. I would have been up here to educate you. Nobody wants that. We're all in the same boat. We're all the same in here. One day, 1 year, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. We are all exactly the same. And it was at that moment that I realized that I don't have anything in particular to say that everybody doesn't already know. I can share my experience, strength, and hope, and I'll say things and people are nodding because they've been through it too. So I'm not that special guy that I used to want to be. And it's funny because I'm coming up on 20 years. This happened in Easter this year, a couple months ago. That I just figured this out. Well, she figured it out for me and told me. Because I learned a long time ago, and so I have to take cues from myself. I have a saying for myself: the louder I am, the wronger I am. And anytime I get into something, as soon as my volume goes up, my brain goes, "Hey, dude, you're getting loud. You must be wrong." If I have justifications in this crazy brain of mine, I'm wrong. You know, it's what it was with my first wife. I would justify things. Well, I can do that because. No. Right or wrong. And it's funny. Steve, the third sponsor I work with, he said something that always stuck with me, that humility is doing the right thing. And I never thought about that, because the humility that I was taught was false humility, self-deprecating. I'm not very smart. Just always putting myself down. But I realized it is doing the right thing. I remember once early in our marriage sharing at a meeting, and I was talking about my first marriage and the fact that I wasn't faithful. And I said, "Well, I'll never do that to Tracy, because I couldn't stand the look on her face." And I went, "Wow, that is just a load of shit." And it hit me, and I sat down and I realized I won't do those things anymore, because that's not the man I want to be anymore. I made a conscious decision that I'm going to go down that path where there are no justifications, where the only behavior accepted is the right behavior, where the only way I can be in life is to be a good, loving, and faithful husband. I'm working on the communicative part. I really am. It's gotten better. That I can. When my dad died, I was able to get up there, and we'd come to peace, and I knew he was sick, and I got there. And I've always been terrified of death. I never wanted to be around it. And I sat there, and he was wheezing and unconscious. And I held his hand, and I told him it was okay. I told him it was okay to let go. And I was there the moment he passed away. And it was odd, because he got so peaceful, and his breathing became regular. But it just slowed, and then he passed. And I realized that I wasn't afraid of it anymore. And I was able to call Trace and talk to her and cry. Blubber and blow snot on my nose and just walk around the street and people are walking past me. And I didn't care, you know? But I couldn't have been there, and I couldn't have been in the space that I was in if it hadn't been for this program. Because I talked about my parents in here. I talked about some of the stuff that happened. And I changed my relationship with them. Not only did I learn to draw some boundaries. I remember once my mom calling me, she's going, they lived in Kentucky at the time, so I'd like you to come out and do some painting in the house. Like a dutiful son. Those were her exact words. And I was able to say, no, I can't do that. I love you, but I bet somewhere in Kentucky you can find someone who can paint those rooms. And when I first came to Al-Anon, I lost contact in a way with a lot of my family because I was not willing to involve myself in the drama. I wasn't willing to gossip anymore. You know, if I'm talking to Annie Bim, I wasn't willing to you know, listen to anyone badmouth Cousin Claire or blah, blah, blah. So the phone calls got fewer and fewer. And that was okay. So I was over here waiting, and my family, we've sort of come back together because they know that I won't engage in that part of it, but I'll be there for all of this. I'll be there for the love and the support. I'll be there to listen to you if you're going through a hard time. I won't be there to listen to you if you want to rag on someone else in the family. It's just not what's going to happen. And I got that because I came to these rooms and I listened to these guys and I go to other meetings and I listen to women. I don't want to just seem like, oh, I came to this room and the men taught me everything. It's everybody. I know there's a newcomer here and welcome, but it's everyone. And the thing that I always marvel at is you never know where you're going to get that little miracle thought. I remember struggling with the fourth step, and some of you guys will nod. You remember, I don't know if you remember Gavin, and we were talking, and I was talking about my dad, my little Hungarian Jew of a dad who didn't buy me the right baseball cleats when I was little. Talk about holding on to something. And he looked at me and he goes, well, did you tell him what kind you wanted? I was like, yeah, no. And he goes, that's your part in it. And I went, oh my God, I understand the fourth step. And it was just a throwaway comment for him. He'd been in program 20 years. And that's the point I was trying to make about not educate. He wasn't trying to educate me. He wasn't trying to show me how much program he had and what he knew. He just said, yeah, that's your part in it. And it clicked. And my brain's weird. When it clicks, it's like a Rubik's Cube. And it clicked. And I understood. And I was able to finish my fourth step. And then read my fifth step. And I know a lot of people are afraid of the fifth step because they don't want to say that stuff out loud. And I sure as hell didn't want to say it out loud. And just having a loving sponsor listen and go, that's not so bad. Wow, man, I thought your life was going to be a lot worse. Okay. Well, yeah. Oh, I did that. Or, you know, whatever. And I remember for the first time thinking, wow, I can actually say everything. I don't have to censor. I don't have to have that voice in my head go, no, don't say that. No, they'll hate you. They'll think you're weird. They will stop talking to you. Because that's how I felt. When I first came to this program, I developed in my brain this great story of my past because I didn't think what I had endured and experienced was enough. So I had this story. I never told it out loud, but it was in my brain because I thought, if that was my real story, they'd like me better. They'd be more impressed with me. And that was the problem when I first came to program. I wouldn't shut up. I raised my hand at every meeting. Wasn't much of a listener. Because I wanted to say something in my share so that at least one person would come up to me afterwards and say, I really liked what you had to say. Well, you're a polite bunch, so someone always did, you know. They throw the new kid a bone. He looks sad, you know. And over the years, I've become a much better listener. Like a real listener, not just listening for the pause that I could jump in, because I got a lot of stories. I got some stories. And so if I tell them and you laugh, that means you like me. I was telling my wife, we were driving up, we've lost three fathers in the last 18 months. Her father just passed. We were driving back up to Sacramento to take care of some things. And we were talking and I told her that when I was in high school, I was basically a stalker. If someone was nice to me, I would look up their address in the phone book when phone books still existed, and I would write them a letter and mail it, asking them to go steady. Because they were nice to me once. That's how desperate I was for love and affection. And I'm saying that for, I know someone went, ah, that's not why I'm saying it. I'm saying it because that's the cycle for me of Al-Anonism, that my parents did what they were willing to do, but not the best. Not, they weren't willing to get past their own injuries to be better parents. So I went into the world where if you were nice to me, I might show up at your door with flowers. Now that's creepy. I was super creepy. And I thought I was romantic. But I was just your everyday commonplace stalker. Thank God there was no internet back then. Jesus. You know, so I, for one, I could tell her that I would write letters and mail them and ask girls to go steady that way because I couldn't talk to them. But in saying that out loud, I realized that's part of where I came from. So where am I now? I heard one of the cake people, he had on a blue hat, I don't see him, say that he doesn't work the program perfectly. Yeah, you're the only one, dude. I don't do anything perfectly, but I try my best every day. I get up every morning and I try my best. I could be more communicative, and I do work on that, but I'm 1,000 times more open and available than I used to be. The two daughters that Tracy brought into the marriage call me Dad. And for the longest time, I was Kevin. And I accepted that. I was going to be Kevin. We had Maddie Potato. She called me Dad. So, you know, 1 out of 3. That's not bad. That's Hall of Fame batting average in baseball. So, you know. They call me Dad now because I got out of my own way and I was willing to do the work. I was willing to put in the time. And that's important to me. And I'm a grandpa now. We have our first grandson. And that's pretty wild. And, you know, she trusts us with her baby 3 days a week. It's mostly Trace because I'm at work, but I'm there. And when he sees me, he smiles. And he'll put his arms up. And, you know, that's a gift that I didn't think I'd have. When I was in my marriage to my alcoholic, and I can say that because she's admitted her alcoholism, I didn't think it would ever happen. And because I was raised to put other people's feelings first, don't scare the children, I gave up. I said, all right, well, no kids for me. So I coached and I umpired and I did all kinds of things, and I would babysit friends' kids for the weekend and things like that. And now I'm a real dad and a real granddad. And I honestly believe I wouldn't have achieved that. I wouldn't have made it through the hard parts of our marriage, of each of us discovering ourselves and being honest about that, without the program, without being able to come here and raise my hand and share my darkest fears and have someone that I could call when those dark, dark thoughts would invade my brain again. And have someone tell me, it's going to be all right. How about you try this? Have you thought of this? Not, man, you're messed up. You're stupid. I don't want to talk to you anymore. I'll be honest with you, we had a bit of a kerfuffle at the house a few months back, and I was acting pretty weird, and I was really tense, And she sat me down and she said, I'm never going to leave you. Now, we've been married 18 years. And I finally believed her. I finally believed that I was worthy of love and that I wasn't the kind of person who could be just cast off, you know, set adrift. My biggest fear when I was a kid was that I would simply cease to exist, that I'd be there and I could see my family living, but I'd just be sort of a shadow over in the corner. Because that's how I felt. I felt insubstantial. Is that a word? She's an author. She would know. I'm substantial now. Someone asked me to describe myself, and I said, I'm this large machine that's a shell that looks human, and there's a tiny little person inside working all the levers. Because that's how I felt. I felt really small. I remember I worked in a factory summers to pay for college. And I remember describing my foreman. He's huge. He's this former Nazi soldier. This was in Germany. And he's gigantic and scary. And I went back and I saw him. And I'm like 3 inches taller than him. I mean, because that's how I viewed people. I remember I was doing a play. Now, there was an actor, and had a big show at the time, and I just remember looking at him like, my God, he's so amazing. I'll never be like him. I was the understudy. So he called in sick one night. So they're putting the costume on me, and I can't wear it. It's so small, I cannot wear the costume. Now, if you'd asked me, I would have said, he's like an NFL lineman, and I'm like a cheerleader. Because that's how I viewed myself. I viewed myself as this tiny, inconsequential nothing. And I don't view myself like that anymore. I still work construction. And when I walk on a job site, I'm the boss. And I'm not the boss in a, you know, puff my chest out and pretend to be the boss. I'm just the boss. Don't do that. Get this done. And I'm not play acting. It's not a persona. It's just me, because that's how I take care of my family. I get up every morning and one of my prayers is, please God, you know, continue to help me support my family, because it's the most important thing I have in my life. And I've been able to get to that realization because of the program. Because I've worked the steps. I call my sponsor. I sponsor guys. I do what's necessary. I open those old wounds that we don't want to think about so that I can heal them properly. You know how they re-break your arm, which I've been through. I've opened all my wounds up. I've cleaned them out. I've sutured them back up. And all the scars are there. They're nice, neat, and tidy little scars. But I don't keep them in a box, hidden away from the world. They're there. I know I have buttons that get pushed. But because of the program, I know I have buttons that I get pushed, you know? Instead of taking it, and then this person over here does the slightest thing, and it's nuclear Armageddon. Because that's how I used to be. People were afraid of me, because you didn't know what would set me off. And when one other thing I'd say, my dad used to describe me as the angriest man he ever knew. And I don't know, do I seem pretty angry anymore? I'm not. Because I kept it all bottled up inside. And then it would just come out of nowhere. And I would do and say horrible things. And I don't beat myself up about that. I've made all the amends I can make. I've worked the program, and I don't do things like that anymore. And it makes me feel good about myself, you know? when I came into these rooms, as dark as I felt, I did not think that would ever be a possibility to feel good about myself, you know? And I do. And not in that, oh, look at me, way that I used to. Or, you know, hey, I got the game-winning hit, so all of you, you know, just the ridiculous stuff, because I didn't have anything that I could hold on to. I didn't have anything that meant anything to me. I didn't have anyone that meant anything to me. And I have so many. And it's an embarrassment of riches for me. And I'm so grateful. You know, I'm so grateful because I came into a room with 15 guys, 8 cool guys leaning against the wall, and they let me stay. And they listened to me. And they encouraged me to raise my hand. And they said to me, you know what, dude? You're all right. Keep working. Keep coming back. And oddly enough, for the first time in my life, I did. I saw it through. You know, I didn't see through my first marriage. And to be honest, it had no hope. But I walked away from everything. I changed my major. I dropped out of college. I quit jobs. I drifted. I did whatever I wanted to do and then split when it got too hard. I don't get to do that now. And marriage is hard. You know? Kids are hard. Grandkids are pretty easy. But he's still a baby, so he hasn't argued with me yet. You know, I'm at peace, not just with the world. There's a lot going on out there, and I won't get into that, but it doesn't affect me. I think one of the greatest miracles, and this will be a stupid guy thing to say, is that I didn't even get that upset when Notre Dame loses anymore on Saturdays. It's like, I love them. I got my share of Irish gear, but I'm not tied to it. You know, when my daughters are sad, I'm sad. That upsets me. You know, when Tracy's father passed and she was broken up about it, that upset me. When my father passed away, that upset me. The inconsequential stuff doesn't affect me anymore. And it's because of this program, because what the program taught me at its simplest, at its core, is this is important. And the rest of it can just blow away in the wind. The key is being able to let it blow away. It took me a lot of years. It would start blowing away, and I'd get some of it back. I'll keep that. And then I'll keep 2 of those. All right, 3. And the rest of it can go. And now I can let it go. I can let the I don't even know that I have a committee anymore. Which is so amazing. All those voices that were always picking at me and telling me all the things that were wrong with me, they're so quiet. I rarely hear them anymore. That's this program, because I've talked it all out. I've reasoned it out with other people. I stopped wanting to be the star of Al-Anon. And to be honest, for the longest time, that's what I wanted. I wanted to be the star so that you guys would love me. And the odd thing is, you guys love me anyway. Even though I just wouldn't shut up. And so now I think, apropos of that, I probably should shut up. So thank you so much for listening, and keep coming back.